Appreciate you being here tonight. Welcome all of our folks on YouTube. And of course, as you probably are well aware, that today is the 80th anniversary of the Normandy invasion in D-Day. And it's been on the things all day long. You know, they had all kinds of ceremonies over there, which they do every year. And the amazing thing is that, you know, they said that the average veteran that took place in the D-Day invasion, the average age is 100 years old. Can you imagine that? And 25 years ago, when they had the Normandy, there was 4 million vets left. And now there's over, just a tad over 100,000 left. And, you know, they represent a generation. We talk about that. I remember when the last World War I guy died. Actually, I remember when the last Civil War guy died. It was in the early 60s. And, you know, when the last person dies like that, that ends that generation. And that's key because we know that for us as Bible believers, that he says in Matthew chapter 24, that the last generation before the Lord comes back will be the generation of 1948. So you can see that Normandy was in 44, 4 years later is 48. So you can see where this thing is getting pretty close to what everything is going on. But having said that, you know, thank a vet. It's a thing where, you know, that was a terrible time that those boys went through. And there's a lot of background to that that most people don't even know about. And a lot of things that you know, you look at it at face value and you don't even see all the things behind the scenes. If you want to do a little behind the scenes stuff, I would encourage you to go online and type in Operation Mincemeat, just like the food mincemeat. And Operation Mincemeat was a plan to foil the Germans and confuse them of where the actual D-Day landing was going to be. So what they did was took a Englishman who died of tuberculosis. I think he died of tuberculosis. And they gave him a fake name, made him an officer in the British Army, or maybe it was the Air Force. And they dressed him up in flight clothes and put him in a canister and in a submarine and took him over to the coast, off the coast of Spain. And put him in like he was in a plane crash. And on him, they had fake plans for the invasion of France, that it would be someplace else. And they knew, because Spain was allied with Germany, because Germany fought in the Spanish Civil War with them, that the German agents would pick up on it and get it and then take it back to Berlin. And they knew that the Germans might suspect something, but the Germans were also faced with the fact that it may be true. So they found this guy, and he's buried now back in England as a hero. I think he got the Victoria Cross, you know, posthumously, obviously. But and so they were faced with that issue. So when the Normandy invasion took place, Hitler and the high command looked at that as maybe a ruse or a fake, that the real one was coming to the other place. So they held back several panzer divisions, and when the Americans broke through and started to really clobber them, they were asking for the panzer division to be released to come to reinforce them, to push the Americans back into the sea, which they would have done. But because they had this other thing that they were faced with, he wouldn't release them. because he actually still thought that it was going to come at Calais or one of those places. That and of course the ruse worked. There was a lot of background stuff that went on that, to me anyhow, was very interesting, and I think that, you know, most Americans just see it D-Day at face value. They don't see the behind-the-scenes stuff, and you know, it's an amazing thing to be able to look at that and to see all the things that went on. Another thing that they did is they built a fictitious army around Patton, 7th Army, which was just a paper army. But they did it to fool the Germans, because the Germans thought for sure he was going to lead the invasion, because they knew and looked and thought he was the best general we had, and he was. But anyway, so they built this army made out of rubber tanks, trucks, by the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And they spread them out all over the field, and from the air or from a distance, they looked like real tanks and real trucks. And it worked perfectly because they, again, thought that the that we had much more there than we thought, and looked at Patton as the one. So there's a lot of things, you know, behind the scenes that are interesting when you look at that. And D-Day is probably the greatest day in American history, certainly the greatest invasion force. And it actually broke the back and began the invasion of the continent of Europe, which in time, with the Russians over in Russia moving that way and we moving this way and then moving up from Italy, the Germans were on three fronts and they couldn't withstand three front war. So that's how they got beat. But anyway, today's D-Day, 80 years ago today, it's an interesting time in history. Okay, enough of that. Our first question's in Genesis 5. Verse 21 through 32. And basically, the question is on verse 31. So let's look at verse 31. It says, "And all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died." And the question it came in was there any significance, is there any significance to him being 777 years old when he dies? And, you know, again, that's a very, very good question. And it kind of dovetails into what you got here in the picture in Genesis chapter 5. So, before I can show you what this may be about, we need to look at the whole context so we can see then how this 777 fits in, if it does fit in, which it fits in somewhere, but we need to look at it. Now, when you get into Genesis chapter 5, it starts in verse 21 with the paragraph mark, and I'm going to read it down through the end of the chapter. It says, "And Enoch lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. And Enoch walked with God after he begot Methuselah 300 years and begot sons and daughters. All the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God and was not, for God took him. And Methuselah lived 187 years and begot Lamech." Now that's the guy we're looking at here. "And Methuselah lived after he begot Lamech 782 years and begot sons and daughters. And all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. And Lamech lived 182 years and begot a son, and he called his name Noah, saying, This same shall comfort us concerning our work and toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord hath cursed. And Lamech lived after he begot Noah 595 years and begot sons and daughters. And all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, what you have here is an interesting study of these guys' lives and the years that they live, which this is a place that illustrates Isaiah 42:9, which I gave you, I think, last Sunday, how that the Bible says that God will reveal things, tell us things before they happen, or his judgment comes, that he will, before they spring forth, he'll give them to us. That's what he's talking about here. So you see this in this picture. Now, the key player in this story is Methuselah, and then Enoch. Now, Enoch represents for us in this story, based on God's telling us in Isaiah 42:9, Enoch represents for us the church. And he gets raptured out over here, and verse 24. But look at verse 21. And Enoch lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. And then it says in verse 22, and Enoch walked with God after he begot Methuselah 300 years and begot sons and daughters. Now, the indication from the way you read this is that there was something about Methuselah and him being born that changed Enoch's perspective of things. And it looks like, from what it says here, it says that he walked with God after he begot Methuselah, kind of giving the indication that he didn't walk with God before Methuselah. In other words, Methuselah is the key point here. Now, the name Methuselah means when he is gone, judgment will come. And so this whole story is built around Methuselah and the years on both sides of him. And where in the story, Enoch represents the church. Enoch walked with God and was not, for God took him. Enoch is the only man in the Bible that is a picture of the rapture in the Old Testament. So you have the rapture taking place in chapter 5, verse 24. And then you have over here, you have Noah. And when you look at Noah, which you put the two together here, you're going to find that let me find it here. Look over at Isaiah 54. Now, these are how you use your types. And, you know, you do what you want to do, but I would certainly, if you don't have it, certainly get this in your Bible tonight. I'll make it as easy as I can for you. Now, look at Isaiah 54, verse 7. Now, this is God prophetically talking about the nation of Israel in the tribulation period. Now, watch. For a small moment have I forsaken thee. This is God talking about Israel. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. Now, look at verse 8. This is exactly what I've been talking to you about on Sunday morning. In a little wrath, I hid my face from thee for a moment. Now, that's exactly what we've been talking about out of Matthew chapter 13, Psalms chapter 10, God hiding himself from Israel. There it is again. In a little wrath, I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer. Now, this is another amazing thing to me, and it's a key, but I can't open the lock yet. Probably never will. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath I heard my face from thee. Now, he says, for a small moment have I forsaken thee. That's from 606 BC up to the end of the tribulation period. And yet in God's time frame, as he's viewing time, it's just a moment. That's quite incredible. It shows you the difference between how God looks at time and how we look at time. Then he said, in a little wrath, I hid my face from thee for a moment. Are you kidding me? A little wrath? I mean, 8 million killed in World War II and the Nazi concentration camps and what the Roman Catholic Church do in a little wrath. It goes to show you that part of our problem is when we look at things in history, in the Bible, we have a tendency to looking at it from a human perspective. And I understand that. That's we're human. But we need to develop the ability to look at it from God's standpoint, from his perspective, because it shows you things kind of in a different light. So 7 and 8 fit right into what we've been talking about in Psalms 10, Psalms 11, and then, of course, Matthew chapter 13. I've laid it out for you where God hid himself going into the parables, and yet showing you that God is going to restore the nation of Israel, Romans chapter 11. Everything just like I laid out for you. Then here's the key. For this, the tribulation the Jew is going to go through. For this is as the waters of Noah unto me, for as I have sworn that the waters of Noah should no more go over the earth, so I have sworn that I would not be wroth with thee, nor rebuke thee. Now, that verse right there, verse 9, tells you that Noah going through the flood is a picture of the nation of Israel going through the tribulation period. It's just that simple. So now you begin to develop this story. We got to do this to try to put the 777 into some kind of understandable format, even though I'm not sure we can completely 100% nail it down, but I can show you where you're at, what you probably have, and then go from there. So now in this story, we have Enoch walking with God, and then God rapturing him out. And then we have Noah and the flood, which now is a picture of the tribulation period based on Isaiah 54. Now, watch this. Come over to Genesis 9. They go through the flood, da-da-da-da-da-da. Everything, type of the tribulation. Look at Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9 will now be a picture doctrinally. Historically, it's Noah coming out of the ark. Doctrinally, it's a picture in our line of the story, Enoch the rapture, Noah the tribulation, and now chapter 9, picture of the millennium. Look at 9:1. They come out of the ark, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. And he comes down through here, and when he comes out of that ark, everything is fresh. Everything is new. Everything that was sinful has been eradicated, and now he is the sole possessor of the earth, Noah, just like Israel will be at the second coming of Christ. If that wasn't enough, look at verse 13. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. That bow is a rainbow. You only find a rainbow two times in your Bible. Once here, and then in Revelation 4:3 and Revelation 10:1. Same context, two different places, but the same context, which is the second coming, and going into the millennium. So the rainbow here solidifies the fact that what you're looking at here is a picture of the second coming of Christ going into the millennium after the tribulation period, typified by Noah as the nation of Israel, after the rapture of the church, typified by Enoch. Now, there's a lot of guys out there today, and it's becoming more of a popular viewpoint that men do not believe that the rapture is a true thing anymore. Most of your neo-evangelical guys have come to the point now where they've rejected the rapture. They don't believe the rapture. They want to tag it back to John Darby at the end of the 1800s and say that he came up with it. And of course, you know, he propagated it and taught it, but he certainly didn't invent it, believe me. And so you're going to find that even some Baptist guys today have gotten so out in left field that they don't believe it either. So it's a doctrine that has been pretty much rejected. Now, the key here is Methuselah. And I want to show you how that the life of Methuselah really is a picture of Isaiah chapter 40, or 40, when he talks about how he's going to show you things. And this is how he lays that principle out. Now, Methuselah means, his name means, when he is gone, judgment shall come. When you start to look at these guys down here, it says that, you know, Enoch walks with God, he has Methuselah. And after he has Methuselah, he walks with God, for 365 years. And Methuselah, now, this is what we're going to look at, he lived 187 years, and he begot Lamech. So now we have Methuselah living 187 years and begot in having a son, Lamech. Then it says, Lamech lived 182 years and begot a son. That son is Noah. So now we have we have 187 years, 182 years. Methuselah now is 369 years old at this point. Now, look over here at Genesis chapter 7 and verse 6. And Noah did according unto all that the Lord commanded him, and Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. So now we got 187 years, 182 years, which brings us up to 369. Adding the 600 years that Noah is at when the flood comes, that brings us to 969 years. In other words, the flood came on the exact day that Methuselah died. And that's why the principle in Isaiah chapter 42 is so prevalent, because it tells us, and he tells us, that before judgment comes, God is going to reveal it and show it to us. This is the example of that. Now, we're faced with Lamech, and the question here it says that Lamech lives to be 777 years old. Now, that's no accident. That is a picture of something. Now, seven in the Bible is the number of perfection. Three in the Bible is the number of completion. So we're faced with 777, which illustrates to us not only something that is perfect, but now something that is complete. Now, what is that? That's the question here. How does that work itself out? And you got a couple of options here. And I would never be dogmatic about this other than a point that it is no accident, and it certainly is something that fits into our time period. Now, the first thing it could be, and I don't think you can nail it down one way or the other than, you know, you got to look at your options here, but we do know that it's something. It means something. It's not an accident. It could be the completion and the perfection of God's finalization of the fullness of the Gentiles before he turns completely his attention to the nation of Israel. Now, I have another question here that I'll just kind of throw in with this one. And that is, could somebody ask me this week if I could explain a little more on the fullness of the Gentiles. Now, come over here to Romans chapter 11 is where we find it. And I'm just throwing this out to you as something that it might fit. But I'm not being dogmatic about it because there's something else it could be. And the Bible doesn't give you enough to know which, so I'm going to throw out the options and let you figure it out from there. He says in verse 25, "For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in." Now, I have told you before that there's two concepts or phrases or teachings about the Gentiles in the Bible. One is the times of the Gentiles, which is found in Luke chapter 21, verse 24. That will be the time from 606 BC up to the end of the tribulation period. That'll be the time as God has hid himself from Israel, and now he is turned the world over to the Gentile nations. So that is the times of the Gentiles. But then here we have that blindness in part has happened to Israel. I told you before, that means blindness in part means that there are some Jews who can see Christ, find Christ, and get saved today. So the blindness is in part. Majority of the Jews are still blind, but some do get saved. Until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Look at verse 26. That triggers verse 26. "And so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written, there is, shall come out of Zion the deliverer." So that is a tribulation and the second coming passage there that kicks in after the fullness of the Gentiles. Now, the fullness of the Gentiles simply comes down, and I mentioned this before, it comes down to the last Gentile that gets saved that fulfills the empty quota of sons of God that exists up in heaven when one-third of the sons of God left with Lucifer. God is a God of order. He's a God of consistency. He's a God that never allows any inconsistency in anything he does, maybe temporarily, but it all has to come back to an exact figure and number at some point. For instance, right now, God's relationship with Israel is incomplete because he's hid from them. But he's going to not allow that to happen forever because he's going to restore them back to him. So you see how that works. Right now, the church is separated from Christ till the rapture. But God is going to not allow that to be a permanent thing because at the rapture we become united one with Christ. So you can see how it works. When Lucifer left the third heaven, the Bible tells us that he took a third of the stars with him, a third of the angels with him. I don't know what that number is. It's obviously a large number. Those fallen, those stars that left with him make up the fallen angels that come into two categories in the Bible when you study it. Unclean spirits, and then the sons of God that came down in Genesis chapter 6, you know, that were with Satan by that point, and they come down and cohabit with women. So there's two or three forms by which they take. All of them are the original ones that came with Lucifer when he leaves heaven back in Ezekiel and Isaiah. I don't know what that number is, but they are sons of God. So now, when that happens, heaven is incomplete because a third of the sons of God, whatever that number may be, has now left, leaving a void or a vacancy of a third of the sons of God. God, being an ordered God and a structured God, would have to replace that number. One of the ways that he does that is a multiple facet aspect of the church. Because when you and I get saved, we become a son of God. Therefore, every person that gets saved in the church age is one more person that fills that innumerable number of the sons of God that left. And when that number is completed, it looks like that's what triggers the rapture. And, you know, there's so much behind the rapture and so much behind the coming of Christ that people have no idea about, because all they ever get is the, you know, the pablum, basic baby formula mindset about the rapture and what God is doing. There's so much behind that that it's a very intense study. But God has to work on a complete system that is perfect and cannot be imperfect. So before God picks up in eternity, and God puts up with a lot of inconsistencies right now because he's working with man and doing everything, Israel, the church, and all that stuff, and then the number that is deficient for the sons of God. So he is temporarily in the church age letting everything play itself out. But when eternity begins and God begins the eternal process that he planned, everything has to be back in order. Israel has to be back in order. The church has to be back in order with Christ. And that third of the sons of God has to be replenished. And so you begin to see where soul winning, winning someone to Christ and then becoming a true child of God, son of God, with everyone that gets born again and becomes, you know, beloved, now are we the sons of God, but it doth not yet appear what we shall be. That's one more completion of the number. And when that number hits that final number, whatever it is, it looks like that's what kicks off the rapture of the church. Now, that 777 of his years, seven being perfect, three of them being completion, could represent the fullness of the Gentiles being completed. And I say that based on the fact that of what the number means and that the fullness of the Gentiles complete something. So it could be that. I'm not dogmatic about it. When something isn't clear in the Bible, I will be the last guy to get up and just want to make a point when it isn't clear. And I will be the first to tell you when it isn't clear. Transparency with the teaching of the Bible is paramount. And when you don't know or it's not clear, don't fake your way through it so you can pretend how spiritual you are. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is this. Now turn over to Revelation chapter 13. Now, you know, and lots of things in the Bible like this that you cannot exactly get a figure on it of what it is, but they are marvelously great studies to take. And you come away, at least I do, you come away with a better appreciation of the magnitude of the Bible, appreciating the fact that you can't figure it all out. And, you know, sometimes, for me anyhow, I like that. I can bathe in the magnitude of the Bible that I'm so stupid that I can't get it, but God just shows me enough breadcrumbs that I can, you know, find my way to the gingerbread house, so to speak. But anyway, look at Revelation chapter 13. I'll pick it up in verse 16, I guess. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he hath the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, everybody knows about the mark of the beast. I mean, prophecy is the big deal today, and everybody loves to talk about the Antichrist, the mark of the beast. Everybody likes to bring that into the church age, you know. Read a story one time, but a guy went to the DMV to get his license plate for a new car, and his license plate had 666, and he took it back because he didn't want to be connected to the Antichrist. Personally, if mine was 666, I'd love that. You imagine the tool that you could do to witness with that if you had a license plate that said 666 on it? But anyway, he took it back. You know, you got all these kind of things, you know, that the people are trying to say, and, you know, whatever. What most people don't understand is that there's a mark of the beast where the Antichrist people are marked in their foreheads. But when it comes to the 144,000 that are the evangelists that preach during this time, when the Antichrist is marking the foreheads of his people, God is marking the foreheads of the 144,000. Come back to Ezekiel chapter 9. This is foreign to 99.99% of the pastors and the people out there. They haven't got a clue. You know, there's many things in the Old Testament that illustrate a lot of things that's going to happen in the tribulation. Now, I've heard, I don't know how many guys over the years talk about in the tribulation, if you take the mark of the beast, that's it and you're doomed forever and, you know, you're going to die and go to hell and da-da-da-da-da-da. And obviously, if you have the mark of the beast, that you're going to die and wind up in hell. Most of them have no clue that in the tribulation, if somebody takes the mark of the beast without understanding everything that goes on, that there's a way that they can, after they have taken the mark of the beast, there's a way that they can lose the mark of the beast. They don't even know that. They couldn't take you to the place in the Bible where there's a story of a man who has a mark like the Antichrist is going to put on. He's in the land of Palestine there, where the Jews are, and he's told to do something, and when he gets baptized, where he's told to be baptized, he loses the mark. And that is a pretty good indication that even though that the 666 seal is a death sentence, if somebody hears the preaching of the 144,000, realizes that there's an indication that they can lose that mark and get rid of it. I'll tell you. Now, look at, and that's going to say, there's so many things in the Old Testament, like Ezekiel 9, that show you what's happening there that nobody gets because nobody gets into the Bible anymore. Now look at Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 4. And the Lord said unto him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in mine hearing, go ye after him, go through the city, and smite, and let your eye spare, neither have ye pity. Slay utterly old and young, both maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary. Then they begin at the ancient men which were before the house. Now, doctrinally, this will be the 144,000 that go out. And while the Antichrist is marking his people, God is marking his people. Now, look at Revelation chapter 14. Now this shows you that it's the 144,000. And I looked, and lo, as a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, here it comes, having his father's name written in their foreheads. Now, when it comes to the Antichrist, going back to chapter 13, you have the mark, the name, and the number. So in the tribulation period with God's people, here it says his father's name on the forehead, but if we follow what the Antichrist is doing, it also could be that number 777. Now, I'm not dogmatic about that. I am dogmatic about the fact that they get marked. That mark is what they're sealed with, that mark. And then they go and they preach to the people who took the mark. And most likely, those who took the mark, if some of them now believe and see the fallacy, it looks like from the story of the Old Testament with Nahum, that they can get baptized in Jordan and lose the mark of the beast. That's the Bible's rendition behind the scenes of what's going to happen in tribulation. So when you come back to Revelation here, or excuse me, Genesis here, and you're looking at chapter 5, now you have the whole picture laid out for you. You have Enoch as a type of the church being raptured out. You have the overall time frame in the lives and the years of these men living built around Methuselah, that when he is gone, judgment is going to come. We have Noah now as a type of the nation of Israel, and now we understand from Isaiah that the flood is a picture of the tribulation, and we also know now from Genesis 9 that that is a picture of the millennium. So what we have here now is a complete type set in an Old Testament story that puts everything into play that we know from the New Testament. So now you have a man, Lamech, that is the father of Noah. So he's right before the tribulation, maybe the first 3.5 years. I don't know. All I'm telling you is that he fits into this story, 777, by perfection and completion. What exactly that perfection and completion is, as I look at it, is one of two things. Now, maybe there's a third thing that I don't see. I don't know. But it doesn't matter because you can't prove any of them. But clearly, you have the fullness of the Gentiles coming in right before the tribulation. Clearly, you have in the tribulation God's 144,000 being marked in their foreheads. So it could be, it's connected with one of those two, maybe both of them, I don't know. But there is a connection. You just can't get enough on it to be able to, but my goodness, I mean, get enough on it. From chapter 5, from Enoch to Methuselah to Noah, are you kidding me? I mean, that the flood came on the exact day that God said it, when this guy dies, judgment is going to come. Wow. That will mean for me and for you that when you get into the things in the New Testament, like Matthew chapter 24, where this generation shall not pass, you better take those things seriously, because it's all based on this story right here. So the 777, great question. That's as far as I can take it. And I give you those two based on what it looks like, without being dogmatic and saying, yeah, that's what it is, because honestly, you know, you can't do that. So any questions about that I can clear up? Who's got the mic tonight? Okay, any questions about that? I'd get that out of your Bible. I mean, that, especially the breakdown, and then get the verses in Isaiah and those places. That is a complete study that you have to have, and it goes from there. Well, the second question came in, and it has to do with something that I preached several months ago when we talked about the ordinance of heaven and stars and everything. And the question has to do with, his question has to do with, based on what I said and what I laid out, he wanted to know, do stars in the Bible represent us in any way, shape, or form? That was his question. And for that, I want you to turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Get that in one hand. Now, let me talk to you about, and to get a context so you understand some things. Now, we live in a world today where the generation that you all represent, and let me have this say, you guys are obviously a cut above the rest, but your generation is as dumb doped as ever could be. I mean, they know nothing about anything. They don't learn anything in school. They don't read. They spend all their time playing video games and never really getting anything about the Bible, win, place, or show, or anything about anything in life. And so that's the state that we're in. So you got to kind of lay things out in a context way when you're going to talk about something. And so we're going to talk about stars here in a moment. Now, let me explain a few things to you. Now, you all were up today and not a cloud in the sky, and you saw the sun. All right, the sun is a star. It's an average-sized star. But it's a star. When you go out and you look at the stars up in the heavens at night, what you're seeing is thousands and thousands and thousands of suns, just like the one we have. Different, we'll get into that in a little bit. Now, our sun is perfect for our Earth, the way God set it up. most people think that the winter time gets really cold because the sun gets farther away from the earth. And then in the summertime, it gets so hot because the earth gets closer to the sun. And you're going to be amazed of how many people do believe that. And of course, that's simply not true. It hasn't anything to do with getting closer to the sun or farther away from the sun, but rather the angle by which the sun casts its rays on the earth between winter and summer. Our sun is, I say it's average, it's about 864,000 miles in diameter. And, you know, in Malachi chapter 4, verse 2, we know now that our sun, I won't get into it again because we've talked about it before, but our sun is a type of the Lord Jesus Christ. There it talks about the second coming of Christ. It calls him the Son of Righteousness, which he is, but the word is spelled S-U-N instead of S-O-N. So clearly opens up a tremendous, tremendous thing about it. Now, look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and look at verse 41 and 42. Now, his question has to do with how do stars relate to Christians? Now, what I'm about to give you is a great study. It's a great sermon. It's a great devotional if you ever want to use it. I have preached this. I preached this the first time close to 45 years ago. And, you know, I preached it, you know, many times since. I haven't preached it for a while, but. Now it says in verse 41 that there's one glory of the sun and another glory of the moon and another glory of the stars. So now we're looking at three glories. Now, the sun, we already know from Malachi 4:2, is a type of Christ. The glory of the moon will be in Job chapter 25, verse 5, which makes it a type of the church. And then another glory of the star. And that'll be a reference to individual Christians. And then he says, for one star differeth from another star in glory, so also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption, is raised in incorruption. Now that's an indication that at the judgment seat of Christ, individual Christians are going to be like the stars that God put up in heaven. Some are going to be very dim, some are going to be very bright. Now, along with that, we want to turn over to Daniel chapter 12. Let's pick it up and read from verse 1 on down here. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people, Israel. We've talked about that before. And there shall be a time of trouble, tribulation period, such as was never since there was a nation even to the same time, and that the time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. That's the book of life over there in Revelation 20, and the books were opened. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to everlasting contempt. And they that be wise, here it comes, shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. Now, those two verses, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and Daniel 12, show you that the resurrection of the dead, us, the church, and obviously Israel too. But for us, you know, it's one star different from another star in glory, so always the resurrection of the dead. Now, also in the Bible, you have the literal stars that I showed you in the ordinance of heaven, Arcturus, the zodiac. Those are literal stars. But in the Bible, angels are also called stars. And in Revelation 9:1, it says, I saw a star fall from heaven, and unto him was given the key to the bottomless pit. It's an angel. You're going to find in Daniel chapter 8, verse 10, that you find an angel likened to the stars. And then in Revelation chapter 1, verse 20, it talks about the seven angels being the seven stars being the seven angels. So you got that to deal with. That pretty much ends the debate on when you get into the birth of Christ in Matthew 2, and you have the Star of Bethlehem, that everybody wants to, you know, make it something terrestrial in a natural sense. So you come up with a theory that it was, you know, a comet or conjunction between Jupiter and Venus and all that stuff. In reality, that was an angel. Most likely the angel of the Lord that was guiding those guys there, because angels in the Bible are likened to stars. People have a tough time with that, and I never understood that. If you go out to California and, you know, you want to get on a bus, and all the movie stars live out there, you know, and so you go to Los Angeles and you take a tour bus and you go through all the famous people and all the movie stars and all their homes. All the stars live in Los Angeles. Los Angeles means city of the angels. See how you can't get away from the Bible? I mean, it's just that clear. So, when it comes to angels for you and for me, based on 1 Corinthians 15, Daniel chapter 12, we're going to go out on a starry night tonight. It says there's one star different from another star in glory, so also is a resurrection of the dead. You find five types of stars in the heavens. Those five types of stars will represent five types of Christians. Yeah. I mean, Romans chapter 1, verse 20 says the invisible things of him are clearly seen from the things that he made. You don't think he just put them up there, you know, for, you know, to light the night. You know, at the judgment seat of Christ, all of us are going to stand, and we're going to shine like one of these five stars. And this is an amazing thing, and it's something that if you've been in the ministry, working with people in my ministry or whatever, you'll make the connection so quick, it's unbelievable. Five types of stars. Now, stars are categorized by magnitude. Very bright stars are 1+. The brightest star in the sky is Sirius, which is a winter star. It's called Sirius Major. It's a constellation of just two stars, the big bright star Sirius, and then, you know, another star, and that's the constellation. It's the brightest star in the sky. It's bar none. I mean, it looks like for me, where I live in Raytona Beach, I'm right in the line for the flight path for KCI. So if I stand on my front porch, I can watch the lights of the planes coming way out. I see them stacked up, and they'll come right over my house because they're coming in that runway at KCI, and I can stand there and watch them all night. And when they get close, they got their landing lights on by this time, because they're only 10 miles, 20 miles out. They're getting ready to touch down. And they're really bright. And Sirius, when it's up, is in my neighborhood where I'm at, is right there where they're at. And it's a thing where, you know, many a times I looked up there and thought that was Sirius, and it wasn't. It was the more I look at it, it's getting closer. And it was one of the planes. But it's the brightest star in the sky. You can't miss it. It looks like a floodlight. And, you know, it's with a naked eye, if you've got normal vision, you can probably see 5,000 stars on a good night. You get out to Colorado or someplace, you probably could see a couple thousand more. But you can see at any given time about 5,000. The stars go from magnitude 1 down to whatever. Most of our eyes can, on a good night, can see down to 5th magnitude. The 200-inch Mount Palomar telescope visually can see 22 magnitude. That's how faint they become. And, you know, it's a thing where, so we're limited to that. But you got five kind of stars that represent five types of Christians. Let me walk you through them here for a minute. Now, the first type of star you're going to find is what we call a supernova. Nobody knows why, but you'll take a regular star, maybe third or fourth magnitude, which is your general garden variety magnitude of stars, and for some reason, it'll start to implode on itself. And it'll start to burn itself out, eat itself alive. It becomes so bright that it'll jump from a third magnitude to a first magnitude. In China, in 1200, there was a supernova that became so bright that you could see it in the daytime. About 1275, I think it was. And then, once they hit a bright phase, then they start fading. And they fade and fade and fade and fade and fade and fade and fade till there's nothing left and there's no light coming from them at all. I've seen a lot of Christians like that. Seen a lot of Christians come into churches, and boy, they get on fire. They want to set the world on fire. They want to serve the Lord. They want to do this. They want to do that. And they jump in. They never get discipled. Nobody works with them. They get gung-ho about everything and go to town. And then 5 or 6, 7, 8 months later, just like the supernova star, they begin to fade out. And pretty soon, a year later, they're nothing. A lot of Christians like supernova stars. A lot of them. Then the next type of star you have is what we call variable stars. Variable stars are interesting because they will fluctuate between 3 and 4 magnitudes. You go out tonight and it's a second magnitude star, pretty bright. 6 months from now you go out and it's a 4th magnitude star. They actually can't be consistent in their brightness. I guess you know where I'm going with this one. And there's a lot of God's people that are just like that. They're variable Christians. They can't stay consistent. They can't stay, their brightness is on a variable scale. They're in, they're out, they're up, they're down, they're struggle. They come to church for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 months and then they're out for 2 months. They're just up and down. We have them in our church. They're in every church. And as long as you're in the ministry and you're dealing with people, you're going to deal with people who are like those variable stars. They just can't stay consistent in their brightness of the glory of the Lord. And just like those stars, you'll go out one night and boy, there it is. And it's really bright. And then 6 months later, you come out and you say, where is it at? And it's just faded. And then it'll come back 6 months later to being bright again. Just like so many Christians that can't stay connected and consistent. So, you know, you have the variable stars. Then you have what we all call shooting stars. And we've all seen those. you're out some night and, you know, they have, most people don't know this, but you have what they call meteor showers. Most people don't know what meteor showers, what causes them. Meteor showers are caused because at some point in time in history, a comet went through our orbit, that the Earth, it passed through. It didn't hit the Earth, it just passed through. The Earth in its orbit will go through that dust lane of where the comet was. When the comet goes through, it leaves a lot of particles and a lot of residue, rock, some as big as cars, houses, whatever. And it's just floating in space because that comet is putting that stuff off. Well, when the Earth goes through that path, those rocks then come through our atmosphere and they begin to burn up. And lo and behold, you see a shooting star. And that's why you'll find that when a meteor shower comes, they'll name it after the constellation that that it's going to come out of, and that'll be where whatever comet, and they usually know what comet it was, because they've been tracking those for a couple hundred years, and they can tell you all that information, but that's what it is. But my point is this, we call them shooting stars, but they're not really stars. They're just pieces of dead rock. And there's a lot of Christians that pretend they're stars that in reality, they're just a piece of dead rock and they've never truly been saved. And they just go through the church like the meteor goes through the atmosphere and they burn up as a piece of dead rock because there's no substance to them. They've never been truly saved. Shooting star Christians, so to speak. That you find. Then you have what we call super giant stars. Usually they're called super red giants. Those are stars that are absolutely immense and bright. I told you earlier that our sun has a diameter of 860 some thousand miles. There are suns out there that if you took our sun 860 some thousand miles, you could put a million of our suns inside that sun. That's how big they are. And they represent the type of Christians that really shine for the Lord. They never lose their brightness. They never supernova. They never variable. They're true shining stars that give off the light, and they represent so many of God's people that are the day star, so to speak, that is the light in the darkness that people can see your life, and it never diminishes. It never is variable. It's always consistent. And it never blows up to the point where it just then descends on itself after it implodes, after expending all of its energy. You burn with a brightness for the Lord Jesus Christ forever. Then the last star is what we call dwarf stars. They're usually called white dwarfs. Has nothing to do with Snow White and the seven that she hung out with. These are stars that are basically very, very, very dim. They're very small. They don't have a lot of energy, hence they don't put out a lot of light. Now there's scientific reasons behind all of these, but I'm not gonna bore you with that. I'm just giving you how they appear to 1 Corinthians 15 and this guy's question of how that they fit into you know, the Christian's life. And it's a thing where you begin to see how that these five different stars that God put in the heavens actually represent. Everything's accounted for. You got the sun, type of Christ, the moon, the body of Christ, the church. The moon doesn't have its own light. It reflects the light of the sun. And then you have the individual stars that are a picture of each of us when we stand at the judgment seat of Christ, how we are going to shine. And you're either going to be a nova, supernova, that burned out. You're going to be a variable that could never be consistent. You're going to be a fake that you really weren't a star. You just blew through and burned up into the atmosphere. Or you're going to be a super giant that you're going to be consistent and give the light off down through the universe. Or you're going to be a dwarf. You're never going to grow. You're never going to develop. You're going to be someone who just is the minimal light giver. And you never really accomplish anything for the Lord. So 1 Corinthians 15:41 really lays out and shows you how this whole thing is a picture of Christianity and the five types of Christians. And you got it all. And as I said, you can develop that into a great sermon. You can develop that into a really good devotion. And you can develop that into a good study and really go on from there. So, well, we'll hold up from there. Let me just say for all of you, you know, we had our first